Great. Thanks very much, and thanks for organizing this wonderful workshop. And indeed, my interest in olfaction started in conversations with Venky and with Chuck at a little micro meeting that Chuck organized in the Santa Fe Institute between the three of us some years ago. Okay, great. So, you know, keeping with the tradition of KITP workshops, especially because there's a 1.5-hour talk, I'm not going to give this talk as a presentation of a whole bunch of results that we've done. Rather, I want to use this as a venue to have a discussion between us, between all of us, on how we should be thinking about the organizational plan of the olfactory system and whether there are alternatives to the usual way we think. So please feel free to interrupt as much as you want. If I need to keep going, I'll let you know, and we'll do that. But this is not a presentation of results. It's a discussion. OK, great. Wonderful. So most of the things that when I actually talk about olfaction that I'll talk about have been done with Kamesh Krishnamurthy, who's over there. Yeah, he's a grad student of the group, and Anne Hermunstad, who's a postdoc in the group. So credit where credit is due. Wonderful. So I'd like to start out by telling you the outline. So the talk is going to consist of three parts. And the first part is going to be about the sort of what I think of as the standard paradigm we use to think about sensory coding and perception, which is vision. It's really hegemonic, right? And in vision, really everything is about order and structure and how you extract the order, how you extract the structure, given the constraints that you have in neural circuits. So I'll sort of review for us and for me the how we think about the overall organization of the visual system. Then I will present what is, in my view, the challenging aspect of olfaction and raise the question of whether or not this standard paradigm that we take from vision is actually applicable or useful as a way of thinking about the olfactory system. And then I'm going to suggest that we should be perhaps thinking for an alternative, that of disorder as the key motif of olfactory processing and circuits, not order and structure. And then I'll try to tell you how thinking in that way leads to several interesting ideas and investigations. And I'll present some initial analysis of data seen from that perspective. And I think it's informative. And we can talk about it. OK? So that's the plan. So let me start with the talking about vision. OK? So, you know, most sensory neuroscientists really get their chops thinking first about vision. And at least theorists do. And really, the way in which you approach the visual system is you start out there in the world and recognize that there's a structured natural world. The world consists of, has many kinds of correlations and order. You know, points of light is correlated. The world is made up of objects and edges and, you know, things like this. And the basic way we learn to think in vision is that circuits are adapted one way or the other to exploit this order in order to reveal what's useful for behavior, right? And the basic theme that pervades thinking in the visual system is that starting at the first synapse, even starting at the photoreceptors before the first synapse, there are multiple parallel pathways that develop in vision that extract somehow useful features, you know, of all the many, many pixels, the features of those many pixels that are useful for vision. And then, you know, you extract these features. So that's a sort of atomic description, if you like, of the visual world in terms of these features. And then you progressively and hierarchically recompose them in a feed-forward way, going down into the deeper cortical layers. Of course, there's feedback, but we kind of ignore it most of the time. And there you go. At the end of the day, you recognize grandma, right? So that's the general plan. So let me just review how that thinking works, because it's had such beautifully spectacular results. It's worth reminding ourselves why it works and how it works, and then asking, can we apply the same set of reasoning tools to unravel the functioning of the olfactory system? And sometimes it may be yes, and sometimes it may be no. So we start in vision with a statistical structure of natural visual scenes, a question which is, for so far, you know, in olfaction, we don't have a good idea of what is the statistical structure of natural olfactory scenes. And a lot of the discussions with Brian, for example, and Hero, and so on, have been, and with Lucia, have been about, in during the workshop and last week, have been about what is the statistical structure of natural olfactory scenes, right? And how do you measure it? But in vision, we know something about this. So here are some images from the UPenn image database. And you can do all kinds of things, right? You can make model red, blue, and green cones. That's the LMN and S cones. You can work out how many photoisomerizations per second you're going to get in each of these cone channels. You can measure all of that. And you'll find, you can measure how correlated the light is between different points in the world. And you find many striking regularities. So one regularity you find is that the distribution of light is always in every channel you choose to pick, always has the sort of low peak, long tail kind of form. It's kind of log normal, so it's kind of skewed so that the mean exceeds the median. And you always find that light is correlated over very long distances in the natural world. And for people who are fond of that kind of analysis, the power spectrum has the log-log plot of the power spectrum is a straight line, which means, in effect, that natural scenes at this level of correlation are scale invariant, which means you take the image, you chop it up into quarters, you take the quarter, you blow up the quarter to fill up the screen again, and the correlations are the same, right? So these two striking facts have been used again and again and again to explain many features of the circuit architecture in the early visual system, right? So we'll come back to that later. Of course, we all know that the real world isn't just these two kinds of statistics. There's many other kinds of statistics, the higher order statistics, that are objects, textures, and you can study those too. For example, you could take a scene, you know, cut it into patches, whiten, binarize, do whatever image processing you want. You could collect in those patches, I don't know, here I've binarized to make things easy, you know, the black and white blobs, and from it you could ask, what is the distribution of patterns of black and white pixels in a 2x2 square? Or otherwise, you know, pick any pattern you want. And this is an example of a way in which you could construct, you know, statistics, higher order statistics that go beyond, you know, pairwise correlation. So you can do all this kind of analysis, and it's easy because you can collect the images easily, right? It's a matter of hiring an undergrad to take photographs, in effect, and then you can do this kind of thing. And what's more, there's even further kinds of statistical regularities, which is that we said that, you know, you could compute, you know, pair correlations and triple correlations and quadruple correlations between multiple points. It turns out that you can plot the sort of set of correlations you get, and you find that the different kinds of correlations, this is a correlation, this diagonal, these sets of different kinds of correlations also co-vary. So there's this sort of hierarchical, you know, at every level of organization, first you compute the statistics, those have some distribution, then you discover the distributions of the statistics also have some distribution, right? So there's this hierarchy of statistics of greater and greater complexity, and it's been an art form for theorists studying the visual world to show, to use these statistical regularities to understand otherwise very surprising things about the way in which the visual system functions. I'll give you a couple of examples of this later, just to illustrate the style of reasoning. Yes, please.
Just because you mentioned grandmother cells are recognizing grandmother, yeah. I thought it would be fun. So if you had a database of images of grandmothers, would you expect statistics to be this line?
These statistics are completely universal, right? So you can take all your grandmother statistics, all grandmas, and you'll find that these particular statistics are the same. You know, for example, some of these things you might have imagined that cityscapes like downtown Philadelphia would be very different from the baboon habitat where we gathered some of these things. They're basically invariant. And we could have a very interesting discussion of why these kinds of statistics are so invariant to all of these kinds of transformations. But I'd rather not go there right now.
Just for fun, I was going to throw that. You would expect them to have power. And you can argue
because there's a scale for the grandma.
Right.
So this kind of thing, of course, works because sometimes you see grandma far away, and sometimes you see grandma close by, and that changes the scale. But photographs are usually taken from a given scale because people like to frame grandma nicely in the image. So when you do this kind of statistical analysis, you have to control for many of these sort of human biases in the way we take photographs and how we pick, you know, nice subject of monkey in the middle, whereas really vision is more complex than that. So there's a lot of controls you need. So that's a good point. Okay.
So maybe a quick question. So this is maybe tangential. You can say so. So these are all images taken typically within the kind of the wavelength range of, you know, animal vision and so on. But if you actually just go outside that, are those images, do they follow the same statistics, or is it something special?
So I don't know is the full answer to that question. But let me make an argument to you that a couple of these things are going to be the same. Let me take the example of the log normal distribution of light. Here's an argument for why the light distributions will always be log normal. Remember that you get normal distributions when you sum things that are statistically independent. Now consider the process by which light goes from an illuminant to your eye. It goes bounce, 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 and comes to your eye. Every place it bounces, a little bit of the light is absorbed, kind of randomly. So you have a multiplicative process of absorption. The central limit theorem for multiplicative processes gives you a log normal distribution. That's why I think you so universally get log normal distribution. So I think that that statistic will be the same. But we'll have to think carefully because, you know, clearly if you're in an environment that filters out all the blue light, there ain't no blue light, right? Those things have to be thought about sometimes in an ecologically specific manner. And that's also an art form. There is a beautiful book called The Ecology of Vision by, the name is escaping me from the late, no, late 1970s. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful book that I recommend anybody who's interested in vision. You know, talking about how the eyes and structures of retinas are adapted to basically the lifestyles of different animals. Lovely, lovely book of a certain kind, you know. Worth reading.
Lithgow.
Right, exactly. Lithgow. I love that book. I have a hard copy of it and everything.
Is it because basically the natural world is fractal or something?
Okay, so I do not want to go into this because, you know, we can now have a lovely after-dinner discussion on this also. But that's essentially right. I mean, I tend to think of it as these things happen because things appear in the world at all distances. So you're going to get many different scales. Also, some processes happen at big scales and small scales. But let's not go there, because I really, it's not important for me why this happens, but it happens, and vision scientists use it. Okay, and we're going to raise the question of whether we can do this in the olfactory system or not, is really what I want to get to. Okay, so how do people studying vision use all of these sort of statistical things to give a theory of the functional logic of the very early visual system. You know, going deeper in, you know, motivations and goals and valences and things have to matter, but at the very periphery, how do they do this? Well, they basically assume, or suggest anyway, that circuit structure should be adapted to A, the structure of natural inputs, B, behavioral demands, and there are surely all kinds of biophysical and evolutionary constraints in how the circuits are organized, and that somehow you're adapted to all of this to perform computations economically, whatever that means, and well, whatever that means. And a lot of the art in doing this kind of reasoning involves defining a reasonable notion of economically or a reasonable notion of well, right? And then people will make some progress. There's a specific incarnation, very popular in vision, and so any theorist going to any other sensory system, even if they don't tell you they're doing this, will try to do this. It's called efficient coding. They'll try to go into the periphery and maximize information transmission because you can do it. Yeah, it's a technical tool that gives you, if you like, a figure of merit for how well a system is doing. So that's a very popular thing to do for that reason. Okay? And again, we have to ask whether in olfaction this makes any kind of sense. Can we do it? You know, do we have enough information as scientists to be able to even try this in a reasonable way? And you know, these ideas go back decades and decades to individual system. So now I'd like to give a couple of examples, right? Practically, what do you do with this kind of idea? And then I want to switch over to see, can you do this in olfaction? So what do you do? So let me take the periphery, right? We've talked a lot about the olfactory receptors now in the last few weeks. Their structure, their nature, are they adapted to the structure of natural ligands? Are they not? Da, da, da. Okay, so let's try. Let's look at what happens in vision. Because there, you've got, you know, cone types and cones and rods. And actually, it's very well known in vision that the peak receptor sensitivity of cones is kind of ecologically adapted. So if you look at the mouse red cone, it shifted red relative to us. You know, and there's mechanisms of gene duplication and variation that you can shift the peak frequencies around. You can tell lots of stories. You know, in Lake Malawi, which is a clear lake, as you go down meter by meter by meter, the fish living in that layer, their, you know, their peak sensitivity has shifted in some way appropriate to the filtering of light. You can tell stories of that kind. And so that's the kind of thing that people would sometimes like to tell with olfactory receptors if they want to talk about them being adapted to the space of natural ligands. To show that this is actually not just talk, you can make it completely practical, right? Let me give you an example of how you do this in vision with a particular striking fact that has only come to light in the last 10, 15 years. That is, you know, all mammals, if you look amongst all mammals have a long wavelength cone and a short wavelength cone, red and blue. And in all mammals, blue cones are rare. They're less than 10%, often less than 7%. But striking fact, it's just always true. Another striking fact, we old world primates go to the trouble of making red cones, blue cones, and green cones. However, there's a tenfold variation in the red to green cone ratios without particularly great loss of color vision. Right? So we go to the trouble of making these things, and then we let the developmental program to be completely sloppy, right? Just goes all over the place. So can we give an account of why you would have these two phenomena? Right? That's an illustration of the kind of question you seek to answer with this kind of reasoning in vision. Okay? And then we can ask, can we ask that kind of question in olfaction? Right? That's what I'm going to come to later. But these are well-defined, completely solid results that people have developed in a place where there's a lot of theory. So let's just see what they do.
But in fact, the ecology, I mean, you've got species very similar ecology, very different percent S cones.
That's not true. Okay. So you're looking at these three lines, yeah, these three things. Okay. Let me explain those three creatures. Those are actually rodents that live close to the ground. And all there's this large class of rodents that has what's called a dual gradient. They have in the inferior retina, which tends to look up, there's a predominance of blue cones, but in the superior retina, which is kind of dealing with its terrestrial vision, there's a predominance of the green cones. So this is thought to be a specific adaptation to you're hanging around on the ground, you're looking for something against a blue background, etc. But
it doesn't make sense anyway.
It doesn't?
No, I mean, well, gerbils.
I don't know if that data point is correct. I don't know if it's been measured very carefully. So not all of these species have been studied that carefully.
Because you've got gerbils, squirrels,
totally. Right, and then there's squirrels and stuff like that. I should go back. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. I need to go back and check that figure. Okay. Right. So we did some large survey of various people's papers, and you know, I may or may not have. It may some of them may have been superior retina, some may have been inferior, and I'm not sure I control that super carefully before making this plot. But that's a good point. People tell these stories about the ecology of vision, da, 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 da. But it is true that at least if I'm going to look at the part of the retina where it's mostly red cones, then it really is there's a binary division between the upper and lower part of the retina. So let's look at the lower part of the retina then.
I mean, there are these wonderful stories, studies of guppies where depending on how many, like, for the predators coexist, then they have color.
This is going to become a theme in what we talk about, you know, there are two modes in which you have to function, right? All animals have to function. One is the sort of lock and key mode where you co-evolve with something, mm-hmm. in which case, you know, you should just do the thing that's right for that thing you're locking with, right? That's one class of things you can do. Then there's the other mode where you have this unknown space of things broadly distributed there that you have to react to. And the way in which you've got to organize your circuits and computations deal with that is totally different from what you've got to do if you've got specificity and where you can guarantee I co-evolve with the flower, right? And therefore, I know what the flower is going to be like. That's a different problem. Likewise, with predator-prey relationships, if it's specific over a long enough period of time, you can get... I'm going to talk more about the second class of problems where you have this sort of unknown space of opportunities and threats distributed across some bigger landscape.
I would also argue the visual system is going to evolve much more slowly, and therefore there's going to be a greater lag between the adaptation to the current environment, whereas the olfactory system actually is evolving more quickly.
I'm going to talk about that exactly. I completely agree that one of the things that makes olfaction really interesting to me is there's a, in effect, evolution of, for example, the receptor populations in your lifetime, right? I mean, because when you regenerate receptors, when they die and regenerate, the proportions change. I'll have something to say about that in a minute. So I view that as faster timescale versions of some of the things I'm interested in, which is part of the reason why I find olfaction very interesting. Okay, so we'll come to that in a second. Okay, so all right, so if you're a theorist in vision, what do you do to explain this kind of thing? You say to yourself, well, I already told you that it's a kind of universal fact that light is correlated over long distances. This is correlation between red cones and blue cones and red and blue cones. There's all these correlations. Then you say to yourself, the ancients already told me that what I should somehow go and do is to organize my receptors distribution, you know, how many red, blue, and green channels I have and how I put them into a mosaic to maximize the amount of information coming out of the photoreceptor array, right? And let's not go into is information the correct measure. I mean, I'm just picking some measure that seems vaguely reasonable, but just see what happens and then take it from there, right? So we'll pick a measure. And that information is really a different way of repackaging the information about the joint response distribution. So like, for example, if you and you teamed up and found out how all the receptors in the bee responded to all the different flower odors, you know, that kind of information is what basically goes into there. You need to have a joint distribution. And from that, you sort of massage that into a number that tells you how many bits you can get out of that. Okay, so it's a repackaging of that information. So you do that, and this is what you find. Turns out that if you take a red and green clone array, and now you have to be, you know, typically when you try to do this kind of analysis, at some point you have to be faithful to the biology, right? So for example, you know, eyes don't exist in a vacuum, right? They're surrounded by pigments and surfaces and stuff. The lens in front of them has chromatic aberration, right? These things matter, right? So you have to be you have to model those things and include them in your analysis, and then you can ask the question about what would be a good distribution of receptors. And what you find is, for example, that if you look at the proportions of red and green cones over a massive range, it really doesn't matter for how much you learn about the chromatic world. But if you look at the proportion of red and blue cones, it matters a lot. You should have mostly red cones if you want to get more information about the chromatic world. And this has to do with all the details of the biophysics and the chromatic structure of the world. So you say, aha, now I have a rationale for the observed organization. Without going to the details of do you predict it within, you know, within 2% or something like that, you have a rationale for the qualitative fact of the dominance of red cones and for the large variability between the red and green cone proportions in the primates. And then you can do more having to do with eccentricities, and you know, you can sort of try to nail this more and more if you like.
Just a quick, you can give a quick insight into how did I go from the previous line, which was measuring information, to this line?
Right. So here what's being done, here what's being done is make up a model red and green cone array. Then what you've got to do is to measure this kind of information. That's hard work, because what you need, you can't really construct a joint distribution of many, many, many pixels. So what you do is you start growing this number of pixels, and then you make some reasoning about what the effect of the correlations is on shared information between pairs of pixels. And then you can that leads you to guess that there should be a power law, and then you take bigger and bigger arrays and you fit a power law, and you realize that there's an exponent telling you how much information you get in one kind of array, another kind of array, with the exponent depending in some way on the relative proportions, and then that allows you to extrapolate to the million cone array that you kind of need to discuss humans. So that's the specific technical method. Yeah?
I heard somewhere that the different cones are at different depths in enrichment, and that corrects for chromatic aberration.
I don't think that's true. I'd love to see the information about that. Yeah.
Play the skeptic. Can you go forward? More forward?
That's about as forward as I have. I have no more here.
No. The actual information curves.
Forward.
Oh, I'm going. This is reversed.
There you go. Good. Okay. Great.
Yeah.
There's not much difference there, but I've noticed that the scale on which they're shown is
good.
Actually...
Excellent. Yeah. Good eyes, Tim. Good eyes. And this also goes back to our previous discussion about does this kind of reasoning apply at all to the olfactory system? You know, how much gain do you really get? So when you apply, so typically when you do this kind of reasoning, you know, per cone, you know, you actually don't get that much more. So then you've got to say, well, but I have a million cones. Well, it takes some time and stuff like that, right? And so in these kinds of arguments, there's always some art. And then you wonder, did you just tell yourself a fairy tale? Again, one of the reasons why I like the olfactory system is it seems to me, as we discussed and as we'll say again later, there are causal manipulations, like changing the olfactory distribution or the distribution of smells, that seem to engender changes already in the peripheral olfactory system, which you could use to test whether this kind of idea is actually a good one, right? I mean, this looks like small differences, but again, amplified over time and over number of units, it could be a more significant thing. At least that's what we would tell ourselves for why this seemed to work.
Well, I agree with that, but I would also just simply say that even the difference between LM and LS is not, can you go back?
Yes.
So it's not that big really, right? So because you're talking about 0.2 bits per cone.
Yeah.
You know, on the bottom one, and you're talking about something like
You're not going to get a big
0.02 versus 0.01.
You're not going to get big pushback from me.
Okay.
Right? So I think these kinds of arguments have to be taken with a healthy dose of skepticism, right? And there, you're feeling that this kind of thinking is useful because it is twofold. One, it works again and again. Mm-hmm. I'll show you another example in a minute where it works, right? And so it seems to work again and again. So that adds to your confidence that maybe you were on the right path. But nevertheless, I fully subscribe to the idea that in each specific case, you should treat it with skepticism. And it would be vastly preferable to have a causal manipulation where a prediction of such a theory is confirmed as opposed to an explanation of existing structure. And that's what I personally would seek to discuss with all you folks in the olfactory system. I think this is a paradigm, right? This efficient coding is a paradigm people use to think about sensory processing all over the place. It's never been tested in the sense of causal manipulation with a prediction, right? So I think olfaction may provide an opportunity. Okay. So, we can raise the same objection for every one of these, and I think it's a good objection, okay. And it's correct, right?
So for these who have this very different LM,
yeah.
So you do all kinds of visual testing using no depressing performance.
So you know, I don't know how comprehensive or complete it is. What people do is they measure the L to M cone ratios, and they proceed. You know, there's some battery of tests for chromatic behavior that people give. And they find something. I'm sure if we're clever enough, we can find a difference, right? Because there has to be, right? I mean, there's some difference there. Right, but these are sort of average measures somehow, right? The information is kind of an average measure anyway. So I'm not sure how wide the battery of tests is, basically. I really would like to move on to the next one. Can I, please? Because I would like to get olfaction. Or is it important?
No.
It's always important.
All right, Christoph, go for it.
I was just wondering, so you picked some peak frequencies for LM receptors, I guess?
Yeah, well, the actual peak frequencies.
Are they always fixed?
For humans, yes.
No, okay, but then you go to other
animals. Yes. So it's very interesting to do it for other animals and see what different things you get.
Yeah, that's just my question. So, right. how
so for the blue and red cones, they're sufficiently far apart that it's okay. Well, the actual very careful data that people have, which I'm sort of plotting and comparing here for proportions, is actually in humans. Because it matters for human vision, so people have looked at that carefully. So the data that's available for the other animals is kind of more rough, right? People have done, you know, Leo Pichel has done the whale, right? And that's one data point, right? Stuff like this, right? So I'm going to treat that with, therefore, a grain of salt, saying that, well, the key point is the blue cone and the red cone have very different and fairly distant peaks. The green cone and the red cone are kind of similar, but the peak frequencies are different between species. Of course, a sensitive test of a theory like this is to be specific to each animal, check out the specific differences, and see if the specific differences are predicted. That would add great confidence, but we haven't done it.
I see. Okay.
And do not plan to, but I invite you to. Okay. So, all right, let me go to the next stage. So this was receptors, and we're going to recapitulate. How am I doing? I started at 11:30, right?
Yeah.
Oh, this is good. This is perfect. So I'm basically going to go through like this, the visual system, and I'm going to redo this again in the olfactory system, trying to tell you that you can't really do things this way. You should do it differently, right? So that's basically the order of this talk, right? So next, let's look at the next stage, right? So here's one of these famous pictures of the Cajal of the retina. Here are your cones. They project into the bipolar cell layer. The bipolar cells talk to the back ganglion cells, and there's, you know, bazillions of, you know, interneurons going this way, providing all kinds of lateral inhibition and interesting computational things. How do we think about this? So in vision, the way in which you get trained to think about this from your first course in visual neuroscience is, aha, the purpose of the retina in this way is to take the visual world, which, as we know, is composed of elementary features like spots, edges, little, you know, local motion, color, and things like this. We know that, and because we know that, it makes sense that the retina and all these cell types, their job is to extract these features of the world because the world is built out of them. So that's basically the first thing you tell a student. And this is all, you know, in the end, heavily informed by a beautiful paper by Letvin in the 50s, is it? Or 40s, I can't remember, what the frog's eye tells the frog's brain. And it basically set the way people think. You think of feature detectors of different kinds, you extract those features, and then you recompose them. So in particular, people look at the zoo of 60 cell types, 60, 70 cell types in the retina, and then you'll see papers getting written where they will trace out how this type of cell, extracting the feature that it is interested in, interacts with this kind of amacrine cell, you know, an inhibitory interneuron that extracts a certain feature that it wants to subtract out of the message to produce this kind of cell in its output, which, let's say, reports local motion from the left to the right to the brain. Right? So that is the way in which you think about the circuitry. You think about all of these circuit elements as being constructed to produce computational motifs that are extracting specific features, and then you catalog those features. Right? And that has been a very productive and very successful activity in thinking about vision. And of course, then it's tempting to ask whether you can do the same thing in the olfactory system. And later on, I'm going to try to suggest no. Again here, people still think about this kind of adaptive coding kind of paradigm, right? It's just the way people think. So for example, they'll talk about adaptive feature extraction. You know, you can ask the question, you've got all these types of cells, but there are certain features that seem to be extracted in this language across all the vertebrate visual systems, but with variations, right? Some animals do different things and so on. But basically, there's a repertoire of features that's extracted. So that feels like, okay, why and how should the repertoire of computational elements, circuit motifs, be divided up into all of these different types? That's a question you could ask, and that is a major thrust of the way you think in vision. So let's just give an example, again, with the idea of can we apply this kind of reasoning to the olfactory system later, right? So let's consider an example, a simple example that's easy to visualize, which is the example of the bright and dark spot detectors in the retina, right? There are these things called on cells and off cells. On cells basically respond to a local spot that's locally brighter, that's brighter than the local surround, and the off cell responds to a spot that's darker than the local surround, right? In olfaction, I don't know how to even think about this because I don't have a geometric visualization of the olfactory space, but you know, vaguely we may imagine this kind of molecule, you know, this aldehyde minus this ketone. I don't know. I really don't know how to think about this. Again, another reason why olfaction is interesting. Okay, so we're going to think about these kinds of cells. And I want to ask the question, well, you know, I have some number of cells. How many of these and how many of these should I have? Right? Let's suppose we ask that kind of question. That's very similar. I've chosen that question to be similar to the photoreceptor question earlier, to just see how you reason it out again in this case. So it's a fact, right, of nature, that the brain actually divides bright from dark equally. So contrary to our yin-yang and God divided the light from the darkness intuitions, in fact, you know, behavioral measurements clearly show greater sensitivity to light decrements and to dark spots. You can measure and see that more cortical cells respond to dark spots and negative contrast. And you can see that retinal ganglion cells, the output cells of the retina, are somewhere between 1.3 to 2 times as numerous as on cells. This is species differences. Right? Cat is like 1.3, primates are like 2, many things are around 1.6, 1.7 times as many. Okay, so there are, it's like that. And just to be really clear, I really mean, you know, you can do this by anatomy, you know, like ground truth. This is wishy-washy electrophysiology, right? You're going to go look at the cells, spot how they ramify the dendrites, right? And see that there are 2 times as many off-bipolar cells as on-bipolar cells in the macaque retina. Done, right? So there's more off cells. Why the hell would that be the case? Is the kind of question that you would want to answer in vision if you want to have an understanding, a conceptual understanding of the functional logic of vision. Of course, the fact is a fact, right? You need more off cells, but you can certainly run with that, and you can certainly talk about developmental mechanisms that give you more off cells, how the circuits work, how you use this later. But you know, why would you do that? It's a question that was not answered until fairly recently. So here's an idea. Maybe in dark, maybe we should go back again in the same style of reasoning, right? Maybe there's something about the world or something about the constraints that makes you have more dark spots. Like, you know, let's say flowers have more of a particular kind of chemical. You know, maybe that matters. So you can just do this experimentally, right? You take a bunch of images, you filter them to see, you know, locate the bright and dark spots and plot how many at each visual scale of bright and dark spots you have. And what do you know? At all scales, there are more dark spots than bright spots. Aha, right? So that's a fact about the world. And you can wonder if this seeds the asymmetry that we talked about in the structure of the retina. And well, so you can try following the same kind of methodology that we discussed before. You know, you have a certain number of cells. You can pick some of them to be off cells. some of them to be on cells. I don't know, find the proportion of off to on that maximizes visual information. Or pick your poison, you know, pick some other figure of merit for, you know, performance of the visual system, like, you know, contrast discrimination or whatever you think the appropriate one is. So we'll pick information. And suppose I ask you how to do this, it's just dead obvious that you should have more off cells than on cells. Why? They'll respond more often because there are more dark spots. So no matter what theory you cook up, you're going to find that you're going to have more off cells than on cells. Right? So that's clear. Then, of course, details matter. For the precise proportion, you got to be faithful to the actual physiology of these cells, you know, the noise levels, how big their receptive fields are. You know, there are many details. You know, what their non-linearities look like. These things matter. It's a particular biophysical substrate which is implementing these things. So if you do that, using, you know, numbers taken from guinea pig for specificity, you get an optimal ratio of about 1.7, which is, you know, beautifully in the middle of the range of the numbers that you get across the different species. Okay? So this is another example of the way visual scientists, by using this kind of combined reasoning about the structure of the world, constraints of the circuits, what needs to be done, and some notion of, you know, adaptation or efficiency, come to some account of why circuits are the way they are, so you feel like you understand how the circuit is working, you know, why this organization and not something else. Again, the overall picture so far is, you know, there's the visual world. You think of the visual world as being built up in a Lego block kind of way, right, in terms of visual features. You pick cells to pick off one Lego block or the other in kind of some kind of vaguely overlapping manner, and then you put them back together.
I'm sorry for not asking naive questions. I'm not sure if I should.
Sure, you should. Naive questions are usually going to be the ones I can't answer, right? But go for it.
By on cell, you mean the right center black surround?
Yeah.
It's not a temporal feature. I mean, you're not asking.
I'm not talking. So that's an excellent question that I would normally go into a standalone talk on the on-off system. As you well know, these things also have a temporal response kernel, namely onset and offset. In fact, you usually find the cell when you're recording by its temporal property. But if you check the statistics of temporal statistics of light, there's no symmetry, asymmetry between onset and offset.
That's why I'm perplexed. I mean,
it's because you transition from bright spots to dark spots when you look around.
No,
as often as you go from dark spots to bright spots, there's an automatic symmetry.
So there is a symmetry in time, but there is no symmetry in space.
Apparently.
And the cells, I mean, you basically have like four types of cells. You have bright center.
You have on center and off center.
Okay.
And they have a.
But there is also a temporal.
Yeah, and there's a biphasic temporal kernel that multiplies it. Like any of these, you know, throughout sensory physiology, you're going to find things that process something, subtract something else. You know, every glomerulus takes something in, subtracts something else, and then. Has something
the,
biphasic.
The temporal component is symmetric, right? So if I take cells which are on center, for example, they would be the same fraction of on and off cells in time.
No. Can I take that offline?
Okay, sure.
Because I am indeed now getting confused as to how to answer that. I see your point. But we actually even checked that by taking these filters and running them over images. It's not the case, and I can't give you a clean argument, so it's better that I take it offline.
I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry. That's a perfectly legitimate and good question.
I mean, if it isn't, you shouldn't be sorry. Because I want to license
that
legitimate question.
That's an old-fashioned.
Why are you studying the brain?
Exactly. Where's Doran if he'd been here?
Oh, my God. Wait, this is being... recorded, right? I said nothing. Right. So, but it won't be. So here we go. So we'll talk about now. So then, let me finish the story in vision, which I've gone on for quite a long time because I feel like this is sort of ground truth for what we know about how to organize circuits. Well, you know, you can say lots of stuff. Well, you know, cortex is really not about these low level, you know, how much light there is and how much correlation there is. It's really about structures like, you know, there's a bear and what have you, or a dog, whatever that is. So you can see that if you scramble higher order structure, higher order correlations, you lose the structure. So it's really about extracting all of these sort of higher order structures, higher order correlations, like the textures and things that I spoke about earlier. And again, I'm not going to describe these slides in detail. You should allow the pictures to wash over you like the ocean. Basically, I'm trying to tell you here that you can really analyze this kind of cortical processing in the same language that I earlier talked about, the retina and about the periphery, namely the receptors. Namely, you work out the statistics of patterns. Remember I told you earlier that you could work out the statistics of different kinds of patterns. Then you ask yourself the question, is someone looking at the pattern, here's white noise, here's very patterned in some way, very patterned in a different way. And you can do experiments where you put, you know, a strip of a pattern on a background of white noise and ask people to discriminate it, right, using whatever cortical mechanism they're for discriminating this. And you can show in great and gory detail that the variance of these kinds of patterns or their occurrence and how often they occur and how much they vary in actual images is very predictive of how salient artificial patterns of this kind are against white noise for you. So there are some patterns which are very bold, but you don't see when they're against white noise, because, you know, presumably because it's not useful to you. So I'm just suggesting that this kind of reasoning can be pursued into cortex and is very interesting as a predictor of the kind of behaviors that people have. Okay? Great. So what are the big themes? I hope I've convinced you that really the big theme here in vision is there's a structured natural world with correlations and order. Circuits are adapted to exploit this order. There are multiple parallel pathways that extract the features which embody this order, which are then recomposed to produce, you know, interesting things inside your head. And that the computations, everything that I've said, has been feed-forward and hierarchical. So this is the way we think. So the question I'd like to ask now is, does this paradigm for sensory processing, which is definitely dominant, apply at all to the olfactory system? So I'd like to start by reminding myself and us of the challenge of the problem of olfaction. First of all, there are a very large number of volatile molecules. God knows how many there are, but there's certainly plenty. I'm going to call it a million for our purposes. Complex odors, a second problem, can contain many odor molecules. It's not single odorants. Maybe it's a couple of hundred, I don't know, right? Jasmine has a 250 or something it is, like that. So we can call this number bazillions. So there are bazillions of odor types. And you can find them in many different concentrations. Different species of moths, as Massimo has studied, use the same, you know, repertoire of chemicals, but with different concentrations. And to tell your species apart from somebody else, you need to tell those concentrations apart. Likewise with flowers and what have you, I imagine, and bees, right? So it makes it seriously hard. A third problem is you've got very high variability, the seasonal variability, right? I mean, the odor landscape is completely different in winter and summer. There's daily variability. There's a night-blooming jasmine here in California, right? Comes out in the evening. You get new plants and animals coming into your life or disappearing from your life, right? There are turbulent flows which produce, you know, micro-scale variability all the time. This is really, really hard because it's changing all the time. What's more, and this is really, you know, for a vision person, gives you, makes you shiver, odors mix rather than occluding like objects, right? You put two objects next to each other, right, they may be blocking, but there's still an integrity of the object. By kicking it, you can see this moves separately from this. You can't do that with odors. And yet, you may be called upon to say that there is skunk there and something else at the same time. Very well, skunk is probably easy. Well, I don't know, jasmine and rose, I don't know, whatever. You may be called upon to do that kind of separation, even in the case where there's no kind of segregation that you can perform. This is an extremely difficult problem.
Wait, but in vision there's a million pixels, right?
But it's retinotopic, right? I mean, it's all sort of local and stuff like that. So yeah, there's a million pixels because there's different locations. At one location, there's one pixel, and there's a certain number of features, maybe 20. That's it. And then you copy it over in different locations. Space is easy to handle.
No, wait, translucence, you know, all those things happen.
Translucence becomes more complicated.
But also, if you're thinking about vision beyond the retina, and you're thinking about it as in recognizing the bear or the grandmother, then the two are more similar.
Yes.
It achieves the same level of complexity at an earlier stage.
I agree. I totally agree with Tim's comment, and I'm going to come back around the outside of this tongue and ask whether we should be applying the things that I say here to cortical vision at the end of the day, because by the time you get to grandma, there is enormous variability of how grandma is presented to your eye, unlike the little pixels and edges and stuff like that. So I agree. Everything is pushed forward in olfaction, and maybe that's why there's so much plasticity early in olfaction as opposed to the visual system, right? So there's a slogan I like to have that the, at least inside my head, the gene adapts to the mean, the synapse adapts to the variance. All I'm saying to myself inside my head is if something is actually stable, you should wire it in. If it isn't stable, you should have plasticity to take care of it. And so the more stable, the earlier on you wired it. So that's my own view of that. So we'll come back to that. I agree completely with that comment. So this is very hard. And of course, the way in which you sense odors is when they bind to an olfactory receptor. Now, another problem for olfaction is, of course, every receptor needs a gene. There are not the, and the olfactory receptor gene family is already the biggest gene family in the genome. You know, you're just not going to be able to buy more genes, right? So you have a limited number of receptors that you're going to be able to play with. And the question is, how could you possibly represent so many odors with, let's say, 1,000 sensors or 100 if you're a fly? To make it clear just how difficult I think the problem is, it's like this, right? So suppose you've got three dimensions, x, y, z coordinates, and I tell you, I insist that you encode where you are with one number x, right? Of course, there are ways of doing that. One way of doing that is to fill the space with a space-filling curve and read out the coordinate along the curve, and that will give you one number encoding where you are. But for our purposes of computation of the brain, that is a completely useless way of doing business, because nearby points in three dimensions will be mapped to very different points in one dimension. So you can't actually do similarity detection and classification and, you know, categorization, stuff like this, in any sensible manner for that representation. So what you want is to, in this case, in this pictorial example, represent these three dimensions in one dimension, but somehow respect all the proximity relationships. But it seems really hard, if you put it that way. And that's, and in olfaction, you've got a million dimensions, and then you've got to represent, let's say, 1,000 dimensions, while respecting, to the best of your ability, all the proximity relations, right? So how can you do this? So let's ask, what would a mathematician do, right? So here's what a mathematician would do. They wouldn't have done this 15 years ago, but about 10 years ago, there were some new results in mathematics which made them realize that they could do this. So you imagine that you have a signal space which is gigantic. So this is the million dimensions later of odor space, right? So each entry here is the concentration of one chemical odor component, right? Then you imagine that this has a property called k-sparseness, which is, I promise you that no more of this k entries are going to be non-zero at any given time. That's like saying, a natural odorant is not going to have more than about 200, 250 components, right? Which just makes sense. You don't want to make that many proteins and send out in the air. You should do what you want to and then stop, right? So imagine a k-sparse signal of this kind. There is a theorem in mathematics that says that if you multiply this, basically, by a rectangular matrix, which is, let's say, I don't know, a little bit more than k. So if k was, say, 100, this is maybe, 200 or something, right? Times n, so a gigantic rectangular matrix with random populated by, honest to God, random numbers, you will get a dense, compact representation, this sort of completely randomized version of this, which contains complete information of this vector, including all the concentrations and everything, and there's an easy way of decoding it, of extracting all of it. I'm not trying to say the olfactory system needs to know the concentration of every molecule. It almost certainly doesn't. It's a proof of principle that this kind of diffuse sensing, really what's going on here is you have a small number of sensors. You can think about this as the response matrix of your sensors. You have a small number of sensors, and their responses to all of these molecules should be random. And if they're random, it'll happen that these sensors produce a beautiful, compact, and complete representation of the world that they're trying to represent, of the odor world in this case, right? So thinking in this way, what's more, the really cool thing about this use of disorder, in my view, is that this small vector here preposterously manages to preserve all the proximity relations, right? So nearby things are mapped, nearby things in this big space, nearby odors, if you like, are mapped to nearby vectors in the small space. So your responses, if olfactory neurons did this, they would produce representations that beautifully have nice similarity relations reflecting the chemical similarity of the original odor. Okay. All seems like a good thing, right?
Do these results depend on some properties of the matrix?
Of course. that depend on lots of properties of the matrix, which I'm skipping a little bit. So really what you need is something called the restricted isometry property. It's a technical condition, which we shouldn't go into right now, but we can discuss later. There are reviews and stuff. It turns out that a Gaussian random matrix satisfies those properties. So neurons, of course, can't have negative firing rates. So imagine some baseline firing rate, and imagine Gaussian variation around that in response to all of these. That'll do the job. It doesn't have to be Gaussian. There's many other structured and unstructured matrices of different kinds that will do the job. But I'll just illustrate it. But to me, disorder is a very useful organizational motif, if you can get away with it, because you don't need to do anything developmental. Or you just wire up randomly is a thing that is useful if you can get away with it, in my opinion. Right? So let's take this as, I'm going to take this as inspiration.
Because
yes.
The number of receptors, where does it show up in that matrix?
The number of receptors is this thing. So you should think about this as a sensing matrix. This row here is the firing rate of this neuron 1, the sensor 1, olfactory sensor 1, to all of the different million possible odorants. This is receptor 2, receptor 3, receptor 4. I'm just drawing a response matrix in the usual way that we would.
Just curious. So I mean, here you exploit strongly the property that everything is fast, right? I mean, and then it's somewhat trivial. So what do you?
Oh, it's not trivial. Somebody got a Fields Medal for it.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Let's be clear. It is not trivial, right? And if you have a quicker proof, write it up quickly. You will be famous.
No. Okay. But like right. In intuition, you make use of the sparseness, so that's why you can actually back down to.
If you're willing to back down and the statement was trivial, I'll agree that now that we know those results, the intuition is clear.
Yeah. So,
okay.
So what would you actually do if you don't have this sparseness?
Yeah. So let's start discussing this.
How can you actually find out structures in your high-dimensional space which might be not sparse, but another feature which gives you better weight?
That's a very interesting question, which I'm actually not going to discuss. You're talking about other kinds of structures that may be useful. So the usual paradigm in vision is that vision also does dimensionality reduction. That's the feature extraction. There, the idea is there exists a basis for this high-dimensional space, wherein some linear subspace, where all the data actually lies. So if you do principal components analysis or some clever trick to find that low-dimensional manifold embedded in this million dimensions, you're in business. And the vision people have inside their head, an idea that the feature detectors of the retina are basically discovering that low-dimensional manifold and writing things down in that basis, right? So in this case, let me try to argue that there is no low-dimensional basis, because if I think in chemotropic space, right, so maybe there is if you can appropriately geometrize chemotropic space in some way. I just don't know how to do that. That's something people have been trying for decades, to give a geometric description of chemical space without success other than inspirational success, right? There's no actual concrete formalism. So I submit to you that there isn't that structure. There's just random things, right, like this. It's sparse because animals are not going to make 10,000 odorants to send out into the world. They'll make as many odorants as they need to signal reliably, and then they stop. And empirically, it's like a couple hundred for complex odors, often much less, like 30, 50. Boris? Well, okay, so Terry Tao got a Fields Medal, not just for that, but for a bunch of other things. No, but it certainly contributed to his fame. The reason most people know Terry's name is because of these developments. It's not the prime number thing that makes him famous to the rest of the community.
Was there a Stanford person who worked with him?
Yes. Well, no, Emmanuel Kandes.
Emmanuel
Kandes didn't get the Fields Medal. So we were talking about the guy who got the Fields Medal. There was also David Downhole.
If it was a Fields Medal for compressed sensing, Kandes should have also gotten it at some point.
All right. We can. All right. Let's be historically accurate. Right. There was Kandes and Tao and Donohoe wrote some beautiful papers on compressive sensing. Tao also wrote a lot of other very impressive papers in number theory and analysis, etc. Tao got the Fields Medal. In the citation, this development was one of the things mentioned. But surely it was for the complete body of work. Is that a better representation of the history?
Perfect.
Okay.
Uncompressed.
It still wasn't trivial. It wasn't trivial.
But Vijay, at the end of the day, in all honesty, I think we should just take this axiomatically for now, right?
Yeah, it's just inspiration.
You just say, like, yes.
Yeah, it's just inspiration.
Sparse, let's go.
But right, because this is all linear sensing. Yeah. There are no linear neurons, right? Right. This pretends there's no noise. There's plenty of noise. Right?
Yeah,
there's all kinds of stuff that's not right.
To be formal also, that matrix is not quite firing rate, it's really more affinities, right?
It's more affinities, right? So, there's lots of stuff that's not here exactly right. But, I'm here taking this as a physicist, not a mathematician. So you know the way physicists work, right? You have some interesting mathematical result, then you feel it. Then you apply it in kind of this kind of way, spiritually, to your problem, and you discover it works. Right? So that's what I'm trying to do. It's a good method. It works.
What's on the next slide?
What's that? He says what's on the next slide.
One second. Does the receptor sensor would be uncorrelated in that case?
Yes, you need these things to be uncorrelated. That's going to be my next slide. No. It'll be a few slides down. I'll start at some point here after babbling on about here in this way, about the general idea. I'm going to start actually trying to analyze receptor responses to see to what degree they do or do not satisfy the conditions necessary for such things. And so then we'll get into the actual biology in a second. So please bear with me.
But wait, receptor sequences are clearly correlated.
Absolutely. We will come to that later. So there's an interesting question. Because, of course, receptors are made by gene duplication and variation. So how random can they be? I view that as a biophysical and evolutionary constraint on how random they can be. So in my own view, often we think about receptors, why aren't they more specific? I think the correct way to think about the olfactory receptor space is these things want to be random completely, but can't because of their constraints. So what's very interesting to understand the interaction of that constraint with the selection for being random. Then there's the question, are they really selected for being random? And Tim and I have an idea for how to maybe approach that, and we'd like to try it out on people for you guys to tell us why it won't work.
You did 30-minute warning.
30-minute warning? I'm not going to get to the end of the talk. That's okay.
No, it's
We'll get to wherever I get and we'll stop.
Cool.
Okay, so, all right, so I think I've already said this. Can the olfactory system exploit this kind of thing? And just to give people I think various people basically raised the question of what's the intuitive thing going on. Christoph, in your case, let me try to give a sense of why I think this kind of reasoning is more general than the specific concrete details of the theorems of compressive sensing. Imagine that you've got N1 monomolecular odorants. This is the million odorants. Imagine that mixtures have K much less than N1 components, like a couple of hundred components. Imagine that you have N2 receptors. That's going to be like our 100 or 1,000 or whatever. And let's suppose each of these things have a maximum firing rate, Rmax, right? This is all cartoons, right? Right? And then imagine that there's a noise radius rho, by which I mean, a neuron fires at a certain rate, but you don't believe it. It could be between this and this because of, fluctuations of the odors in the world, because of firing rate, variability, all kinds of stuff. So there's something. So, right? So the sort of representation space involves R2 neurons, N2 neurons, firing with a maximum rate, Rmax. So you have this sort of volume, R max to the N2, which is the representational space in which you can talk about odors, right? Now, what you can do is you can imagine that every given odor, right, it somehow gets projected into this representation space, and because of noise, it makes a little ball, right? Anything inside this little ball in the representation space is the odor too, because there's noise, right? So this basically counts the volume of balls. If you choose N1, choose K, that's the number of possible mixtures. You take these mixtures and you assign each one of those mixtures a distinct ball, right, in the space, because it's a distinct order, because it's different molecules, right? So that's the idea, right? So then you say, well, this should be equal to this, right? This volume, representational volume, must be packed nicely by these balls. That's the best you can do. If you try to pack any more order representations, you will get problems because these balls will start overlapping and then you'll get confusion. So that's fine, right? But this is the best you can do for uniquely identifying the odors, right? Theoretically. So you can work it out, and you can see that if you want to represent mixtures of 10 components drawn from, this should be 100 molecules, with a maximum firing rate of 10 hertz and noise of 5 hertz, right? So that really means the binary neurons, so really lots of noise, right? They either fire a lot or they don't fire a lot, right? So really, we're pushing the thing because you can do better than that with olfactory neurons. Then you need at least 100 sensor types. Right? That's actually not... not bad, right? Yeah, that's because the number of possible odors of this kind, I guess I didn't write it down, is, I seem not to have written down the number. So there are about 10, there are 10 to the 8th. There are 10 to the 8th possible odor combinations that you can distinguish in this way with 100 neurons, right? That's pretty damn good, right? So you know how we always talk about combinatorial coding in the olfactory system, and you know somehow doing combinatorics of all the neurons and yet having proximity relations? In a sense, this kind of idea, sort of randomizing the representation, achieves that. It's a practical way for the circuits to achieve that. Otherwise, you know, how do you do it? Right, so this is a way to achieve that. Yes?
So if I understood correctly, you have 100 molecules and 100 receptors.
I meant to say 10 to the 8th. This is supposed to be the exponent. Okay. There's 10 to the 8th possible molecules, right? So there's 100 million possible molecules. And I'm promising you that interesting order mixtures have no more than 10 components. You can take care of this kind of order world completely. Again, with neuron, with about 100 sensor types. Well, you know, if you add in noise, maybe you need a couple of hundred. You know, this is order of magnitude estimates of what you need. So I'm just trying to justify. It is a good thing, and if evolution didn't invent it, it should have. It's easy, right, to try to randomize things. Okay, so let me repeat to you. Did evolution invent this? Well, let's look. Here's some basic facts we all know about the actual olfactory system. So here is data from Hallam and Carlson showing the binding of different receptors to a panel of odorants. And you see that a lot of them are pretty broadly tuned. These probably, they didn't find the ligands that actually bound to this receptor, so I'm not sure I believe this very much. But these are pretty broadly tuned. I know these things look like nice localized receptor fields, but don't believe that, because in each of these pictures, basically, there's a scrambling going on of the x-axis so that, you know, odorants that produce large responses are clumped together and it produces this. We may pictorialize that in this way. If there was a way of geometrizing odor space, we might say that this rectangle is the space of odor shapes or something, and these big blobs are what each of these neurons respond to, so in this sort of fuzzy, overlapping kind of way, they're covering everything. So that looks, well, I won't call it random, and we'll see it isn't random, but certainly diffuse. Famously also, after going to the bulb, when you project up to the cortex, there is substantial evidence that the projections from the bulb to the cortex are at least disordered. Again, I hesitate to say random, because who knows, there may be some secret order that we haven't discerned yet, but they're definitely disordered. There's nothing like the kind of specific projections and structures and things that we see in the visual system. Okay? So this definitely looks disordered. So that leads to a hypothesis that perhaps the brain strives to randomize order information as the mathematicians would recommend. And really what we should ask is, just as efficient coding in the visual system was basically a lever for investigations, for coming up with ideas, proposing experiments, and, you know, doing studies that would guide you, we can ask whether this idea is a lever for investigation. Does it generate useful ways of thinking that change our mind about what we should do and generate new kinds of questions? So I'm going to go after that next in the last 20 minutes. 10 minutes?
25 minutes. There are some questions there.
Sure.
So when you say random projections of the cortex, you mean if you pulled out one pyramidal cell and compared it to another pyramidal cell, they would receive different combinations of inputs
they do.
Receptors.
They do.
Right. But that's what you mean by random.
That's all I mean by random. Right. So we could mean something more specific by random. Right. So what makes a thing random is actually a tricky question in its own right. So here, what I want to mean is, let me talk about this in terms of the development of the olfactory system and the way in which the projections from the mitral cells select the cortical target. Right? I'm going to suppose here that they just sort of wander around, and by luck, something happens, and they connect to something, connect to one pyramidal cell. If you agree that it's purely random like that, there's a statistical distribution of synapses that you expect to make. You know, there's some chance of making one synapse of the bulb with a particular glomerulus, or two or three, depending upon how many mitral cells are coming. This is a distribution. Chuck has been looking into that, or was looking into that, or maybe Shyam or somebody. And maybe you have a comment.
Where's Shyam? Here.
Do you have a comment? No, okay. Well, we can discuss that later. So that's a statistical test for a certain kind of randomness. The reason I use the term disorder is when people check for, you know, which glomeruli project a given pyramidal cell, how many synapses, etc., they don't seem to find any particular order of any kind. It just seems random. So I'm using the term random in that way. Well, I'm using the term disorder because random can mean something specific to a math person. Okay. So that's all I mean right now.
Vijay, so there is a
also here mapping from molecules to receptors.
Yes.
And that's encoded. That's the formula that you wrote.
Yes.
But then there is decoding step that happens in the cortex, right? So that's what you're suggesting.
So I would like to.
It cannot be random because it should be conscious about.
I am not suggesting that the cortex decodes odors. I'm actually trying to push against the statement that cortex decodes odors. That was part of the discussion last week, however inarticulately, right? That there is no need for cortex to decode odors. Hold on.
It's not million dimensional, it's thousand dimensional.
I'm going to come to exactly, there's going to be a slide later. Why is cortex big, right? Because walking down this thinking, we would conclude in the end that if you did this, you just need 1,000 neurons, maybe a couple of thousand neurons after accounting for noise and thresholding and stuff to completely represent odor space. Why is cortex big? We've been sitting on a paper that we've been writing now for 2 years, basically because we would like to give a nice explanation or argument for why cortex is big. So, right? When we presented this as cosine last year, we said, yes, let's write this up. And we said, but why is cortex big? So I will try to make some suggestions later. Again, I really look forward to people's comments because it's the point that holds us up. We have an idea, but, you know.
It's like 100,000 cells. It's not so big. It's just like a number.
Exactly. It's not that big, right? It's like 100,000. And then you can very easily get from 1,000 to 100,000 by making arguments, for example, about the fact that you may need to project the same information differentially to amygdala versus prefrontal cortex and have it be modulated in different ways. And then a randomized architecture will allow you to dynamically recruit cell assemblies that project one place or the other place are modulated differently. For example, if fear is modifying the representation of a smell somewhere, it's not obvious that the representation should be modified in its projections to your motor system, right? If you're afraid, you may still need to get away and know what, I don't know. This is not going to be very nailed down. But can we come to that in just a few slides? Yeah.
It's a general question. You're assuming that there is a lot of orders in the world and you need to perceive them. But you can also think about the system completely differently. Maybe the animals just evolved completely differently. They are interested in one order.
Yeah.
That's what she's supposed to them. And they develop receptor for that.
Absolutely.
Then after that, they have another order, and the byproduct of it that they can also
absolutely
recognize.
So this is an excellent point, and this is the alternative hypothesis. We need to have at least two that we can compare something to, and that would be an alternate. And I'll try to suggest in a moment tests of how we could see the difference between selection in those two ways, in the olfactory receptor bindings, right? Excellent point. And as I said earlier, right, if you have that kind of lock and key mechanism where, you know, you're trying to buy, you know, you and that creature or your friend, right, trade information with this molecule, then you should make your receptor careful for this molecule and you co-evolve. Then you find this molecule. Then you find this molecule. And then you could say that, and then your ability to sense general odors is just, you know, a epiphenomenon, right? I mean, it just happens because you get it. That's a perfectly fair alternative idea. It's good that it's an alternative idea. And so then now let's sit, and then we can start investigating which of these it is, and why, wherefore, what benefits it confers, and so on. Right? Good point. Right. So now I'm going to finish in the last 15, 20 minutes by talking about, you know, let's push this. Right? Sounds nice. Now let's try to see what we can do to test this and elaborate and see if it's a useful idea or not.
But Vijay, just to be interrupted, but I think to follow up on Alexei's question, so you're thinking of both the mapping from the order space to the receptors, all the way to cortex, is all two different random matrices, or one large?
You can, if you want, think about it as one random matrix. Then that raises the question, why did you have the bulb in between?
Yeah, sorry,
I have a story about that I'd like to tell that actually came out of rather intense discussions last week at the Ideas Lab, because several of the people who were there were very interested in centrifugal feedback. You know, the different roles that you have. So let me tell you my cartoon picture of this.
Not if it's going to distract you from your 15 minutes, though.
Okay, let me do my 15 minutes, and then we can get to that. Good question. Okay, so big puzzle and good questions. So now let's talk about sensing odors as it really is. So this is data you've already seen. This is olfactory receptor neurons. This is the sensing matrix. You know, a panel of odorants, a panel of receptors. You can see that there's some kind of vaguely disordered looking, but somewhat structured response matrix. This is a model of the antenna lobe. So if you take right in the antenna lobe, at least one view of what the inhibition in the lobe is doing is that it's sort of normalizing the activity. You know, inhibition does normalization. I personally think there are so many different species of inhibition that they're surely not just doing normalization. There must be some interesting modulation driven by, you know, centrifugal feedback and stuff like this, but let's leave that aside. If you normalize it in the prescribed fashion, then you can see this looks a bit more disordered and random and stuff like that, right? So this is trying to justify that maybe the next stage is kind of making the thing a little bit more disordered and random. I want to point out that following up on, I think, somebody's question, maybe Christoph, the disorder response matrix is definitely correlated, right? So this is correlations. So what's being done here is this is correlations between the responses of different receptors averaged over all the orders that were presented, right? So yeah, it's 25 by 25, okay, but 20 by 20 here, right? So it's that correlation matrix. So you can see that there are eigenvalues that are non-zero, et cetera. So there are correlations in this response matrix. And this particular correlation matrix presumably has something to do with the fact that the receptors, you know, all evolved via gene duplication and, you know, and then variation and so on. And they're not completely different from each other. They are related in some way. So there are going to be correlations in their response. At least I'd like to think that way. Of course, sometimes it happens that a small change leads to a complete conformational change, then you're in a completely different part of the space. But let me not try to wrap my head around that at the moment. Okay, so there are correlations. Now, how do we think about the adaptive sensing here? So one idea, so one alternate idea, okay, this is going back to your point, right? So one idea is, instead of being sort of trying to be random, these things are trying to be adaptive, right? This is this molecule, that molecule, that molecule. And we have one example where we can sort of experimentally in real time study adaptive sensing of this kind. That's the immune system, where, you know, receptors bind specifically to specific antigens. Of course, when they bind to that antigen, they also have some broader cross-reactivity. So they also pick up some other things, right? Exactly as you're saying, but they're really trying to get this one, but they'll get some other things on the way, that kind of thing. And you can, let me first ask, is it even an askable question for me as a theorist to sort of think about how that adaptation occurs? What would I predict? Is there a method to come up with a prediction of that hypothesis? And there is. So this is some paper I wrote with some friends, Thierry Moore and Alexandra Balchak, a year ago, where you can ask, for example, for the immune system, what receptor distribution minimizes the time to recognition of antigens or pick some other cost, right? A plausible cost. And then you can just work things out, right? Mathematically, through the statistics of the meeting between molecules and stuff like that. And you work out that the best receptor choice is locally random, but at a broad scale, it's concentrated on more common antigens, maybe not surprisingly because you need to get them, but actually it has heavy tails. There's more weight on the rare antigens than expected. So if I was to sort of loosely translate that in the olfactory system, I'd expect a focusing of the receptivity of receptors on the, you know, on the odors that I think it evolved with or that are relevant, with some tail that's heavier than you'd expect elsewhere, right? But it may be a different cost function in olfaction, but, you know, just reading poetically from the statement. Another interesting comment is that, at least in this case, there are plausible self-organization dynamics that can lead the thing to adapt itself to this. This is all done, I mean, this kind of analysis is done in a very artificial setting, right? It's done in a setting where you suppose that the pathogen distribution is not evolving, it's static, it's well mixed, you know, these kinds of things, the kinds of approximations that theorists have to make to actually give an answer. But you know, over a period of time, it gives you some sense, right? It's a sort of figure of merit for what it means to be well adapted. Okay, and I think these statements are going to be more generally true than the specific model that we looked at. Okay, so that's just deriving inspiration from another adaptive molecular sensing system. So this is actually Tim's slide, and Tim then suggested that maybe he would discuss this afternoon, because you could then ask, so then you have a sort of kind of, you can try to get to a prediction. So this is do you want to talk about this, Tim? Why don't you say something?
Given that you are short on time, I actually say, why don't we could talk about it later this afternoon.
Okay, so basically it's a proposal for a strategy where in some restricted space of biologically relevant molecules, you can ask whether the receptors are tuned to the particular ones in this receptor, in this molecular space that are tuned to the particular molecules that you know appear in this molecular space? How tuned are they, and how broadly tuned are versus broadly tuned, right? And then you could try to use that to separate the two hypotheses of selection for tuning versus selection for, you know, coverage. So there's an idea there that we can discuss later. So, and then you can do further things. So another way in which you can study this adaptation versus sort of diffuseness hypothesis is we do know that there's adaptation receptor numbers. So if you have this experience-dependent remodeling of the olfactory periphery, and the fractions of the different ORNs can change. These colors are supposed to represent changing the fraction. There's many experiments, including by Tim, but others, Dulac, Minghong Ma, many others have been thinking about this. And there's evidence for many mechanisms for changing the receptor population distribution. For example, Catherine Dulac has a very interesting paper showing that, I think, receptors that are not used as much become epigenetically marked in some way that promotes their apoptosis, and therefore they die off more quickly, and thus you get an enrichment of the ones that are used more, right? And there are other papers which show the reverse, that more used ones are depleted, right? And actually, you can, if you're as a theorist in ongoing work with Monasson and Coco, who'll be here next week, so you can talk to them, right? Both of these could be the right answer. So if you smell a lot of an odor, because it's always there, it's kind of boring. You don't want to sense it as much, right? But if you smell an odor often, because the scary thing comes into the room often, you need to sense it more, right? So there are different things you need to do depending upon the valences and importance of the things. And so it's very interesting to try to understand to what degree this is adapted, isn't adaptive. No, it isn't the receptor shape, right? But it is the populations. And this can be definitely studied theoretically, right? And then compared with experiments, I think this will be an interesting direction. And anybody who wants to talk to me about it, I'd be very delighted, okay? So this is, again, I'm trying to set up. Here are some predictions of, you know, adaptive models. How do you study them? And because you need to have something to compare. Okay, so now the alternative is sort of decoding odor identity from diffuse sensors. But that doesn't have to be orthogonal, because you could do some adaptation of receptor numbers while nevertheless fixing the receptor type. So these are not completely orthogonal hypotheses.
But again, it's like eye contrast, it's getting it. But I think it's very different. So the things that you mentioned are not changing the receptor repertoire, right?
At all.
It's changing the sensitivity, but it's
correct,
more or less. So I think
exactly.
I just want to make sure that it's actually different from,
yes,
you originally thought about sort of just different sensors, but
exactly,
it's just different copies.
So that's why I said this thing, yeah, of changing sensitivities is not orthogonal,
yeah,
is not orthogonal with the sort of random sensing hypothesis. The tuned receptors, the repertoires, that is orthogonal to the disordered sensing hypothesis. But this is not completely orthogonal. But nevertheless, you know, we should add it to the soup, because we know what happens. It's interesting, and it plays into both kinds of pictures, and it will affect our interpretation of experiments in both pictures. So we have to be aware of it and understand what's going on. Okay, so that's why I put it.
In a sense, it is actually conceptually orthogonal to the random sensing hypothesis, where the random sensing hypothesis says you can cover space even if you don't, you know, give a damn about what any individual thing looks
right,
like. And therefore, if you don't give a damn what any individual thing looks like, why would you bother?
Okay, so I have an answer for that.
Yeah.
The reason I said, absolutely, the reason why I said it's not orthogonal, if you think, that's the first thing to say. The second thing to say, but wait a minute, I actually have finite receptor repertoires. There's noise, there's this, there's that. So because of that, you know, my capacity to do these kinds of random sensing things, in fact, degraded. And then if I really, really know that I should put all of my eggs in this basket, because I really don't have to sense that part, why not improve things a little bit for this thing that I really care about, right? So because then, you know, another way of putting this, it's sort of value-driven, right? Earlier, we were talking about being good at sensing everything equally well. But you really may care about some things more than others, in which case, no harm in trying to do whatever it takes to sort of mold that a little bit, right? So again, this is a very fertile area for investigation, and there are many things that haven't completely been worked out. Okay, I'm nearly done, or not. Let's see. Yeah, okay, great. So here you go. So here is this diffuse sensing kind of picture. So here's some data. Okay, analysis of data. So remember, our picture is that there is this random sensing matrix. So what I'm going to do is, this is what Kamesh and Anne did, actually. So you take your responses recorded by Hallam and Carlson, and then you they recorded responses to molar molecular odorants. So then you mix it linearly, right? You suppose that if I mix two orders in some proportion, the responses are in that proportion. That's not completely right. In fact, it's sort of wrong in various different kinds of ways, right? Including, you know, some of it is competitive binding, like in your paper, and you know, the other nonlinearities. Let's not worry about that for the moment. Because really what we want to do is not to suggest that the olfactory system uses this clever compressive decoding algorithm. We just want to test whether the responses have enough information to decode, you know, complex combinations. Whether the olfactory system cares to do that specific task is completely a different issue, right? So what's being shown here is a sort of phase plot. As you increase the number of neurons that are involved in the decoding, on average, the complexity of the odor that you can decode with confidence increases. So you can get with 25 neurons, you can decode about 4 to 5 component mixtures. That's about 70 million combinations. And if you say your threshold for detection is 67%, then I don't know, it's like you can pick off 8 mixtures and 8 components, right? This is get 8 out of 100. That's a lot of orders. What is it? It's a billion orders or something like that, order combination. So you can do very well. What's that?
Are you using Carlson data to do this?
Yes. This is done on the Carlson data set with linear mixing because they didn't do mixtures.
Yeah, yeah. So no antagonism, anything?
No antagonism, nothing like that. I'll talk a little bit about, you can use the Laurent data set to try to get a purchase on that, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. So really, in the end, there's going to be a plea for we would love to have more data from somebody, right? Can I just keep going for a second? Because I just want to describe the next, it goes together and you'll have a combined question, right? So then, this was the olfactory receptor responses. We don't have, in that data set, antenna lobe responses. So let's model it using this sort of model of divisive normalization proposed by Rachel Wilson's lab, right? And then you get some other response matrix. And now you linearly mix those, and you see how well can you decode. And if you look at these curves, the blue part is where you do really well. You can see that that decorrelation that's happened because of the divisive normalization definitely improves things. So now you can decode 6 to 7 components with high accuracy. And if you're willing to go to 67% as your performance threshold, then you could get up to, you know, 10 components. That's a lot of different odors you can build, right? 100 choose 10 is huge. So this, so the Carlson data set, you know, contains the information in it to do all of these amazing tasks of separating these odors. That doesn't mean we do it, right? But still, it's there, which I kind of find amazing.
This data set includes mixtures already, right?
It doesn't. So it's monomolecular.
There are a few, but
it's not enough. I mean, there's a handful. Right, this, the big panel is still like this. So this is, I'm going to skip the slide, but this is basically, you know, poor us as theorists, we don't have a lot of data, so we try all kinds of statistical tricks to take the response matrices and expand them in a way that preserves all the statistical properties and everything. Can you, somebody, please take a very large data set, many odors and many receptors, we would benefit from it, and this would test these kinds of ideas well. So this is just exposing our pain. Right? So now I want to end. I'm not going to get to cortex. So we can take that offline later as to what cortex is doing. But I want to end with sort of one more point, really, about what's happening in the bulb, because many things I've said have been slightly fakey in various ways, such as, for example, when you have odor mixtures, you know it's not completely linear. There's antagonism sometimes. Sometimes there's facilitation. There's time, right? Things change in time, and we haven't used that at all in what we've said, right? So how about we try to push to see what we can do about that kind of thing? So here's an interesting analysis that we're developing or thinking about. This is really Anne's idea. And that maybe we shouldn't be thinking about decoding the odors completely and finding their concentrations and anything and stuff like that, because, you know, animals probably don't care anyway. So instead, let's think about the topology of odor space. So this is a picture taken from a paper by Tutunia and Shen and Laurent from last year, right? So you consider a whole bunch of monomolecular odors. You mix them in some combinations, and you mix them in further combinations, and you draw a graph of relationships based upon inclusion, right? So, and what you're concerned about, we're going to be concerned about, is not decoding how much of one order or another order you have. Anyway, that data set always had equal mixtures or, you know, something like this. It's really trying to see whether the neural representation, the neurometric embedding of this into, let's say, response of neuron 1 and neuron 2, right? Whether that preserves, how well that reflects the inclusion relationships between the odors, right? So a good, okay, so let's discuss that. So here you have neural responses to many mixtures, and then we're simply plotting R1 and R2, two neurons, right? how they respond, and then drawing lines between things that are supposed to be connected. So what would be a good neurometric representation? So there's actually a method from circuit analysis that Anne has been adapting. So this is what you do. So this is the neurometric space, right? So each of these blobs is the response of neuron 1, neuron 2 in response to some complex order. These lines are these sort of topological inclusion relationships, right? This order contains these two components and, you know, things of this kind. And then you do the following thing. You draw a box around every node, and you count how many edges come into it in this neurometric embedding. Then you draw a box around two nodes, every pair of nodes, you know, and you keep going like this, okay? And then you it turns out that in many cases, empirically, people have found that it'll turn out there's a power law relationship between the number of edges and the number of nodes. So then a log-log plot, there's some line. You plot it, and you pull out the exponent. This is called the Rent exponent after Mr. Rent, right? And this exponent is small if the embedding, neurometric embedding, respects the topological relationships, namely the inclusion relationships, in such a way as to put nearby things, included things, close by. So if things that are included in each other are close by in the neural representation, this exponent will be smaller, right? Here we're, you know, trying to figure out a new way of analysis, right? It gets tiresome forever and forever taking the neural data and doing a linear classifier and saying, oh, maybe it's linear, maybe it isn't linear, maybe I can separate this. We need to think of creative new ways of doing things, right? So maybe this is an idea for one, okay? So let's see what happens in the Laurent data. So here's a trace order presentation. You know, it's that the neurons are all bobbling along. You present the order, psh, something happens, it fires, and then it slowly goes back up to whatever the baseline was, okay? So you can take an epoch before order presentation and an epoch at order presentation. What's being shown here is that same neurometric embedding, except instead of talking about neuron 1 and neuron 2, it's the principal components of the activity of the population of neurons that they recorded, right? Really, you should do this in the full high-dimensional space, but I certainly can't draw a picture. You can see that before order presentation, it's a mess, right? The embedded graph of inclusion relationships is a total mess, and then it becomes much more structured the moment you present the order. And then you can build the Rent exponent here. It's 0.93, and here it's 0.52. So what is definitely true, right, is this embedding respects much better the inclusion relationships. That need not shock us, right? Because it should, right? It's responding to something. But still, we are pursuing the idea of doing an analysis like this to understand to what degree, you know, adapted receptors versus random randomizing, how it affects or changes this kind of ability to represent the inclusion relationships in a much lower dimensional space than the space of orders.
I don't even understand the left plot because there's no order there, right? So how do you even put labels on those nodes?
Well, you know what you're going to present. This is just a. This is supposed to be the control.
I see. Okay.
Right. This is the control saying
this
that
is real,
yeah. This is data. This is the control. But you know, for the control, we're using this epoch where you know that nothing's happening. So you better not find that something is happening because if you did, your analysis was not useful. So this is the control. All good? Yeah. Okay. So I'm basically out of time. So I'm not going to talk about the piriform cortex. Rather. You know the picture. So our basic prediction, this is the last, second to last slide anyway. So basically, if you follow this our line of analysis deeper into cortex, the kind of prediction we'd be making is that very small neural assemblies, a few hundred neurons in cortex, would suffice to support behaviors. And the thing that's held us up for a couple of years, is that true? So it turns out, I found out last week, that there's a paper by Gloria Choi and Richard Axel and company in Cell, which shows that optogenetic stimulation of small assemblies is sufficient to drive behavior. So we had a grand old time, at least on Wednesday last week, discussing, so why is cortex big? Right? Exactly the thing that's holding us up, and which she's interested in, and I think Richard is interested in. And so really our hypothesis is that the olfactory information should be recopied multiple times for projection to each downstream target, and then, you know, for modulation separately from each downstream target, and that each target, because of the randomness, should be able to flexibly train and recruit small assemblies in order to do the job that it needs to do. So the randomness provides a flexibility as opposed to sort of a compressive quality in this case, right? It distributes information well is the idea. So we have various ideas on how to test it, which we don't have time to discuss. That's my conclusion. Olfactory circuits may use the power of randomness to represent information odors, information about odors, in a small number of neural responses. This may be a general strategy of information processing exploited by the brain, etc.
But Vijay, I mean, there is an argument that projection from bulk to cortex is random.
Yes.
But you didn't use that projection.
I did. In the last, not to talk about the sensing in the first place, because the sensing is actually done by the receptors. But I didn't particularly talk about that randomness as reorganizing the information. The projection, I didn't talk about the randomness and projection from bulb to cortex as further compressing the information or anything like that for several reasons. One is we've tried, at least computationally, to ask if that is a good hypothesis. And we don't think it is. The reason is already in the bulb, you know, you remove many correlations, but there are plenty of correlations left. It turns out that if you randomize that, right, by projecting to the cortex, you just smoosh out those correlations. So we thought, oh, but there's lots of inhibition in the cortex. Maybe this sort of further remodels the representation of everything. In our hands, because we don't have data, right? I'd love to have more data, right? But so in our hands, if we model that, it doesn't seem to reduce the number of neurons, if you like, with which you can make your identification. So that's in our hands, right? So somebody else may find something else, of course. But they may think better about it. So that leads us to the question, so well, for why were you randomizing in the first place? Why are you randomizing? And so the proposal that we would make is that it's already distributed. And then if you distribute it nicely all over, well, you can pick this 1,000 neurons and do that, this 1,000 neurons and do that. You can modulate this. The bulb, there's lots of descending feedback. When the descending feedback goes back to the bulb from the cortex, it doesn't matter which 1,000 neurons it uses, right? It's just all much easier to learn and train if you don't have to specifically target these three neurons. Anything will do, so long as you have a large enough set. So that's a powerful computational motif in its own right. And we would propose to you that the olfactory system perhaps utilizes it.
Yeah, I mean, I have a personal opinion that I don't think that there's as much order in the olfactory bulb as people pretend. There are glomeruli, but I think, you know, we ourselves have shown that the nearest neighbor glomeruli are no more similar to each other functionally than
spatial order.
I think that spatial order is completely misleading.
The point is that the spatial order is the randomness that we're talking about. So what are the ordering talking
about? Yeah,
there's
yeah.
So my point is it's not as if there's order in the bulb and then you're disordering
I
think there is nothing to be done.
I
need the glomeruli to converge all the receptors.
I fully endorse that.
So in a way, it would be amazing if we actually had a bloody order. The
spatial order that people talk about is just the fact that receptors of a given type collect in a glomerulus.
Yes,
but they have to, right? They have to sum their inputs or sum their outputs or something, right? They're sensing the same thing, right? So I don't think that's ordered either, but I didn't want to go there because...
That's fair. So I think this can obviously go on for many hours now. In fact,